Well, I think we'll go ahead and get started. And I think most of you know I'm Ed Martin, the director of the Center for Interfaith Engagement, and we're so happy to have Dr. Amir Akrami here, who is an expert on Rumi, and we're really enjoying hearing his both his background information on Rumi as well as some very good poetry. So we're looking forward to another evening with you, Amir. Amir, we're anxious to hear from you.
Thank you very much, Ed, for the introduction, and thanks to you for coming at this time of the night for another Rumi session. Although very briefly, but hopefully, I think, to some extent, comprehensively, we dealt with the issue of love in Rumi's thought last time. So if you have any comment or question, then we can talk about them tonight, as perhaps we didn't have much time last time to delve into perhaps more in-depth understanding of those aspects of love that Rumi talks about. Tonight, what we're going to do is basically to reflect on some of the stories that Rumi tells us in his other book, Masnavi, which is the book that, as I have already explained to you, is more didactic, more manageable in terms of us being able to understand it, as the other book, Diwan-e-Shams, is more kind of, as I call it normally, is wild, is very highly imaginative, and one even can say, to some extent, even in itself, given the explanation that I have already given you, intoxicated. In the other book, in Diwan-e-Shams, we are dealing with a man who is not putting any restraint on his thought and on his imagination and on his experience. So he is not bound by any limit that he puts on himself. So he has just kind of gotten rid of himself, so to say. And he kind of indulges in sharing with us his profound spiritual experiences. So that's far less manageable than the book that we are going to be focused tonight. Both of these books, as you may well remember, are the poems book, by poetry books by Rumi, as opposed to three other books which are in prose, and I have already talked about them a little bit as well. The reason why I chose to reflect on these stories, first of all, is to get something in terms of the content of these stories, but at the same time, also in terms of the style or the format by which or in which Rumi gets his message across. So both in terms of the format or the style or the means by which he tells the stories, and he actually conveys his messages and his teachings to us, and also at the same time, the content of these are also important. We are dealing with, in these two volumes, as again I have already told you, with 6,000 lines. And I don't remember exactly how many, but I think some hundreds, maybe 250 as far as I remember very vaguely, there are stories in this book, short, medium size, and very, very lengthy ones. And the style of Rumi is that he starts a story, and then by the least kind of excuses, he would jump to another story. And then in the middle of telling the second story, he jumps into the third story. And sometimes he comes back to tell us to complete the first story after sometimes hundreds of lines and sometimes tens of pages in the book. So he is just looking for any kind of excuse to, even sometimes these are in terms of the relevance of the subject or the theme, or in terms of the relevance of, or just one simple word would lead him to jump from one theme to another. So again, they are not really in terms of a kind of logically structured lecture that you would expect from any teacher or any writer or any author, as the kind of improvised nature of these gatherings and these poetry can tell us about how they were told and how they were written, in fact. So, and even sometimes there is no excuse at all. He just, in his mind, he just jumps from one theme to another. So sometimes one can kind of logically follow that this was the first point, this is the second point, that's the logic of it, why he has jumped from theme A to theme B, but there are some places where you do not have any, absolutely perhaps no logical explanation why he does that, and it's just a matter of recollecting something and seeing something relevant that comes to his mind. And one of the kind of recurrent theme in many of these stories and many of these things is again the issue of love. But one important thing that perhaps I have already talked about it is the limit of language. Again, working normally with analogies and similes and anecdotes and stories, one of the things that he uses is that it's like you are at the edge of the roof of a building. So you are falling off the roof. You need to be careful that you are dealing with very sensitive, spiritually sensitive things. So just go down or keep silent. If you just go on like this, then you cannot, the audience cannot bear with you, or you cannot really do justice to the theme that you're dealing with. So he always and always, after some tens or twenties lines, reminds himself and also the reader or the audience that there are limits of language. So I told you some stories, and by those stories, I try to convey to you some message, but you always and always have to bear in mind that there are limits to human language and human intellectual and conceptual apparatus. Let's start reading some of these stories. Again, as I said, they are normally more than each one of them more than tens of lines. So, and then jumping from one theme to another would not allow us to follow the whole story. But I'm going to just give you a couple of examples of these stories to show how he actually works with them. A couple of important themes among in these stories I should talk about perhaps a little bit before we get to tell the stories from Rumi themselves. One of the main things that we talked about at least very briefly when we were talking about the idea of love in Rumi was that love is something which does not accept any associate. So the beloved is someone who doesn't like any associate. And this is for Rumi actually the heart of his understanding of Islam. So there is emphasis in the Islamic tradition on the unity of God, but this unity of God can remain a very abstract, metaphysical, philosophical, theological idea for theologians and philosophers and perhaps for many Muslims. That is one thing. The other thing is to experience that. And that's the heart of his spirituality. It's not just to believe that there is one God somewhere in the abstract, somewhere. It is to be able to unite yourself with God, who is the beloved. And because the beloved does not accept any associate, the love has to be as pure as possible. So the purity of the heart of the lover, human being, with respect to God, the beloved, is one of the absolutely important things for Rumi. So let's deal with one of the stories in which he talks about this issue. I am getting this story from the first book of Masnavi, that you can find on this website. Oops, what happened? Okay, that's the story. The story of the person who knocked at a friend's door. His friend from within asked who he was. He said, "'Tis I." And the friend answered, since thou art thou, I will not open the door. I know not any friend that is I. So let's read the story, and then if there is anything unclear, I will try my best to explain to you if I can. A certain man came and knocked at a friend's door. His friend asked, so normally it comes with a title. That was the red or brown or orange line that I just read. And then this is the body of the lines or the poetry which tells us the story. A certain man came and knocked at a friend's door. His friend asked him, "Who art thou, O trusty one?" He answered, "I." The friend said, "Be gone. 'Tis not the time for thee to come in. At a table like this, there is no place for the raw." Raw means a person who is spiritually not ripe yet. "Save the fire of absence and separation. Who will cook the raw one? Who will deliver him from hypocrisy?" So there is an element of hypocrisy. You have come to you the door of the beloved, and he or she asks you who is at the door, and you are saying, "I." So there is still something left from you that will make you not really worthwhile to be able to enter in the beloved's house. So there is an element of associating something with the beloved, which is termed here as hypocrisy, not purity of heart. "The wretched man went away, and for a year in travel and in separation from his friend, he was burned with sparks of fire." And this burning and fire is again one of those recurrent themes that perhaps we have touched upon at least in the previous sessions. And hopefully we will have time to again deal with it later tonight. Anyone can see it from this distance to be able to read it for me? I don't know if I can zoom in more. No. Anyone can read it from there you are sitting? Or it's not the mic? Okay, that's good.
"That burned one was cooked. Then he returned and again paced to and fro beside the house of his comrade. He knocked at the door with 100 fears and respects, lest any disrespectful word might escape from his lips. His friend called to him, 'Who is at the door?' He answered, 'Tis thou art at the door, O charmer of hearts.' 'Now,' said the friend, 'since thou art I, come in, O myself, there is not room in the house for two eyes. The double end of thread is not for the needle. Inasmuch as thou art single, come into this needle.'"
Thank you. So that's the story. If you go to the beloved's house and there is still something left from your ego, then you are not really a worthwhile lover. You need to go back and purify yourself by the fire, a fire that you need to set yourself on, a burning inside your heart that would purify you, so that next time when you go back and he or she asks, "Who is there?" you would say, "You." And when there is no I and you, there is only one being, one existence, which is the existence of the beloved, then there is a unity here, then the person can enter. So that's the heart of, I would say, generally Islamic spirituality. So in order for the human being to be able to unite with God, there should be, in terms of understanding and changing of your mindset, and more importantly, in terms of something that the person has to put in practice in their lives. And the main thing in terms of practice, which would enable the lover to be able to get rid of his or her ego and be pure, to be able to unite with the beloved, is detachment. Detachment from bad habits, detachment from anything that would kind of impede the unity between the lover and the beloved. Of course, it sometimes, as I have already again explained, they use the term death. But this is not, I mean, obviously this is not a physical death. It is a spiritual death, which means you should die of your present habits and present attitudes and mindset, and behavior and totally change yourself, purify yourself. It is the thread that is connected with the needle. The eye of the needle is not suitable for the camel. How should the existence body of the camel be fined down save by the shears of ascetic exercises and works? So there is an element, especially in the beginning, because as I said again earlier, the whole Sufi journey or mystical journey in Islam, it comprises of two main aspects. One is what we may call insight. The other one is the practice. And these have a kind of dialectical relation in the sense that each one has direct impact on the other one. So you start with some insights, and then appropriate to those insights, you would develop some practices, which in turn would affect your insights, and they just elevate each other, and they go hand in hand. So one of the things that is essential for the any novice who would practice this Sufi journey is a kind of ascetic life in the beginning. Can you see these? So there is always, in the beginning, some steps essential for the novice that may not be as necessary or as essential for a person who is in the middle of the wayfaring. We did talk about wayfaring in the nature of this Sufi journey. So there are things that are necessary in the beginning that may not be necessary afterwards. But one has to be aware that these things are, and some ascetic kind of things. It's like a kind of shock that you would put yourself to, you would subject yourself to in order to get rid of the old habits and old ways of thinking and being in the world. And when you put yourself on that, under that shock, then you are able to then rehabilitate yourself afterwards. So then again, there are, I mean, after some time when you are past this this beginning period, then there is no necessity for any kind of ascetic life. Then you can start to develop your normal life. But then this normal life will be seen in a totally new light. So how should the existence body of the camel be fined down, save by the shears of ascetic exercises and works? For that, O reader, the hand power of God is necessary. So this is one of the interesting things that is, especially when we think about the similarities and differences between Islam and Christianity, seems to be interesting to me, is whether or not the wayfarer should exclusively think about his own attempts, or there should be some places where the hand of God, the grace of God, the blessing of God, some intervention on the side of God, or perhaps other things, the saints or other human beings is necessary. So this is what the Sufis, especially in the Islamic tradition, they call it inaya, which literally means a particular attention paid to the Sufi, to the wayfarer by God. So that is, according to the Sufi, is a necessary thing. So you do your attempts, ascetic exercises, but at the same time, the hand, the power of God is necessary. That's the grace of God. For it is the be, and it was, referring to a particular verse of the Quran, which says that at any point when God wants to create something, he says, or she says, or it says, to it, be, and then it comes to being. It is. Be, and it was. So there should, it's a necessary component of this whole process, the grace of God, the command of God, the attention of God, the blessing of God. For it is the be, and it was, bringer into existence of every seemingly impossible thing. By his hand, every impossible thing is made possible. By fear of him, every unruly one is made quiet. What of the man blind from birth and the leper? Even the dead is made living by the spell of the Almighty. In my understanding, I think, because there are many that would be, perhaps we can devote two or three, maybe three, four full sessions to a discussion on how Rumi talks and thinks about Jesus in Masnavi particularly. He has, if not hundreds, at least tens of lines referring to Jesus. This is one of them, at least indirectly, the miracle that Jesus did, bringing to life a dead person and also healing the blind. So what of the man blind from birth and the leper? Even the dead is made living by the spell of the Almighty. Of course, it is in the Islamic understanding of these miracles. It is done by Jesus, but it is Jesus is not divine in the Islamic tradition. It is ultimately done by God. But this unity between Jesus and God is the main performer of the miracle. So that's one of the stories that is interesting in terms of how Rumi talks about the unity between the beloved and the lover, human being and God. Any comment or question about it before we go to another story?
What's said about the how of detachment?
How, in terms of what it means?
How does one detach? Yeah.
Which one?
How does one detach?
The main thing for Rumi, actually, it is this kind of ascetic steps in the beginning. More particularly, he is very keen to think of as a very powerful and instrumental step of about hunger. So that's one thing. So you know that in Islamic tradition there is fasting, but apart from that, it's not limited to Rumi. Rumi actually, I think, gets these ideas from the Prophet of Islam and many companions of the Prophet, where they would emphasize hunger. He thinks that if you fill yourself with the physical bread, you are depriving yourself of the spiritual bread, which comes to you in terms of light. So for Rumi, a Sufi is a light eater, not bread eater. And he says that if you can experience the beauty of eating life, and this is, he puts it in this very literal way, eating light, in Persian, nur khar, someone who literally, it's light. If you can experience the beauty of being a light eater, then you would just get rid of any bread, light versus bread. So this is one of the things. Another thing is hunger. Apart from that, another thing is silence. This is highly important for Rumi. One of the things that influences Rumi on that is a very prominent figure in the Islamic tradition. Again, you can refer it back to the saying and the recommendations of the Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and also companions, and in the Shi'i tradition to the Imams. But specifically, Rumi was influenced by Al-Ghazali. We did talk about him, I think, again, in some of the previous sessions. Al-Ghazali was very keen about the impacts of silence on the spiritual, on the spiritual welfare of the wayfarer. He thinks that he actually tells his own story. He says that Al-Ghazali was actually he lived in 11th century, 5th Islamic, 11th CE. He became one of the most famous theologians of his own time, being involved in many theological, philosophical debates with his peers. And he normally would defeat his competitor, being so knowledgeable, deeply knowledgeable in the Islamic tradition. And he tells these stories in a very brief book. which has been translated into English as deliverer from error. Deliverer from error. He says that at many points in these debates, I came to see that when I tried to put myself under scrutiny to examine my own intentions, why am I doing this? Why am I so eager to get involved in these debates and then so fervently try to argue against my opponent, and then at the end he would normally defeat, and he was the highest philosopher, theologian in the Islamic world, teaching at Nizamiyah, which was the one of the best universities at that time, 11th century. And he says that I put myself under close examination, and I came to realize that it was not because of the sincerity in my heart. It was because I wanted to show to the other, to the opponent, and to the king, and to the people that I am the triumphant one. So there was no sincerity. And from some point onwards in his life, he makes some vows. One of them is to never visit any king, never get involved in any debate, and be as silent as possible, as much as possible. So this is one of the vows that he made. And he talks about the spiritual fruits of silence. So this is another thing that has influenced Rumi in particular. As I said, there were also grounds for it in the Islamic tradition. I don't remember anything in the Quran, but in the sayings of the Prophet and the other companions of the Prophet, there is a lot of emphasis on the importance of silence. So hunger and silence. Another thing is night vigil. To wake up during the night and pray, at the same time contemplate. So the quiet of the night and the wonder of the night, for them, again, one can refer this back to the sayings of the Prophet or even the Quran. The Prophet of Islam, not every Muslim, the Prophet of Islam himself, just as one person, was highly recommended by God in the Quran to wake up during the night and say their prayers. But this is something that, again, Sufis were kind of trying to extend it to others. Not obliging everyone, obligating every Muslim to do that, but as a kind of recommendation to every Muslim. So this is another thing. Another important thing in this regard is solitude. There are lots of discussions in many Sufi books how to do it and how much to do it. Again, in the beginning, and beginning may take for a person 1 year, 6 months, or even 10 years, depending on different people, things are different. But in the beginning, when you have not totally changed yet, you are still the old person, and you need to kind of try to rehabilitate yourself. During that time, one needs to go to solitude for a while, 6 months, 1 month, whatever. Again, the tradition tells us that Muhammad himself, even before he became the prophet, he used to go to the cave 1 month every year. And that's exactly the month of Ramadan, actually, where Muslims fast. So they took it as a very important indication that the solitude actually nourishes human soul. The main thing is that when you are engulfed by all the disturbing thoughts, that is an essential and natural thing when we are kind of involved in daily business or daily life, then these become normally a hindrance to a spiritual nourishment and a spiritual perfection. So one needs to get away from the crowd every now and then and try to be alone. So solitude, hunger, silence, night vigil, and the most important thing above all of these is a constant remembrance of God. Which in Arabic and also in the Sufi tradition is called zikr. This normally starts with uttering, using your tongue, but it shouldn't stop there. One has to cultivate a heart which is always and always in constant remembrance of God. So it starts with using the different names used to refer to Allah in the Islamic tradition, and there are, according to some traditions, 99 names, or especially in the Shia tradition, there are prayers or supplications where there are 1,000 names of God, different names of God are mentioned. So to use your tongue and with the presence of heart to utter those letters and words, thinking of God and remembering God. But then it should extend beyond that and should go to the heart. So after some points, even the tongue is not used anymore, but the heart is fully present with the remembrance of God. So these five things. There is another element which is also highly important in the Sufi tradition, is that all these things should be somehow closely monitored by a person who has already trodden the path, who is the peer in Persian, or in Arabic, the sheikh, the person who is more spiritually experienced and can perform as, that can function as a someone in whose hand you put your hand and he gets you from point A to point B. So the supervision or guidance that comes from the more experienced person. These are the most important and relevant things that comes to my mind, at least in terms of the practicalities of how this detachment can be cultivated. Any other question? I have always said to myself that we, and I was told by Trina, that I should always give some time for you to read Rumi. And I don't know why I just keep talking and I forget about it. So I don't know. Sometimes when I ask questions and nobody answers, then I kind of find the excuses to again carry on talking myself. So if you feel like to really share some of the stories or anything from Rumi or from any other Sufi or any other author or poet, I would really be glad to hear it from you. So maybe I should stop in 5 minutes from now, and then we will have some things from you, and also again questions and comments and critique. One of the stories that I have told you several times, but it's good to hear it from Rumi himself, is the stories of the Chinese and the Romans. I'm sure some of you vividly remember that story, but it's good to read from Rumi himself how he talks about it. This is 3473. Yeah, here we go. The story of the contention between the Greeks and the Chinese in the art of painting and picturing. So that's the title. The Chinese said, "We are the better artists." The Greeks said, "This is highly hypothetical things. It's not, I don't remember any part of any history of any country where Chinese and Romans were citizens of one king or one ruler. Do you remember something like that?" So it's just a story that he tells. He's not concerned with whether or not this is true historically and factually speaking. The Chinese said, "We are the better artists." The Greeks said, "The superiority in power and excellence belongs to us." "I will put you to the test in this matter," said the Sultan, the king, "and see which of you are approved in your claim." The Chinese and the Greeks began to debate. The Greeks retired from the debate. Then the Chinese said, "Hand over to us a particular room and let there be one for you as well." There were two rooms with door facing door. The Chinese took one, the Greeks the other. The Chinese requested the king to give them 100 colors. The king opened his treasury that they might receive that which they sought. Every morning by his bounty, the colors were dispensed from the treasury to the Chinese. The Greeks said, "No tints and colors are proper for our work. Nothing is needed except to remove the rust." They shut the door and went on burnishing. They became clear and pure like the sky. There is a way from many coloredness to colorlessness. So again, he jumps from turning the story itself to something more deep, more profound. There is a way from many coloredness to colorlessness. And colorless is God for him. Everything that we find in this world is somehow colored. Is there anything that does not have any color? I don't think so. maybe air, some gases, I don't know. Apart from them, then everything has a particular color. The only thing which is colorless is God. And Rumi is always keen to play with these, with the contrast between these color, colored, color, colorless, and so on. He's, one of the things that he plays with it is, the terms is existence and non-existence, or nothing, being and nothing. So he says that normally we think that everything which exists is really that which exists, and everything which is nothing, which doesn't exist, is nothing. But for him, the exact opposite is the truth. He gives us this kind of analogy. He talks about a flag on which there is a face of a lion. And the wind blows to the flag. So you think that the lion is attacking you. But in fact, the lion is not attacking you. What is there is the outcome of the blowing of the wind. So the wind is that which is everything in the story, but you do not see the wind. Wind is nothing. The flag and the face of the lion on it and the attacking that you imagine is everything to you, but in fact it is nothing. So that's the story that he talks about, this kind of, what is it called? Horseshoe, yeah? Horseshoe. Horseshoe is the thing that they put under the sole of shoes in the, I don't know if they still use it. I don't know what is the function of it. But the function of it for Rumi is this, that in old days when some robbers, some thieves, would go to, for their burglary or anything that they would do to go to a house or a place somewhere to rob people of their money or assets or whatever, what would happen was that when they try to flee from the scene, they would put the horseshoe on the sole of their horses in the exact opposite way, so that when they run away from the scene and when the police comes, rather than going this way, they would go that way. So they would be totally misled by the opposite horseshoe. And for Rumi, the whole world is a horseshoe. Everything that you look at it in this way, in fact, it is the other way around. So one of the things is this, that you would look at the flag. It is the lion, apparently, but in fact, it is the wind that you do not see it at all in the scene. So this playing with colorlessness and color is something that reminds me of all these things and many other things that we do not have time to talk about. There is a way from many coloredness to colorlessness. Color is like the clouds, and colorlessness is a moon. Whatsoever light and splendor you see in the clouds, know that it comes from the stars and the moon and the sun. So you do not see the main thing. You are just seeing the less important things. So when the Chinese had finished their work, they were beating drums for joy. The king entered and saw the pictures there. That sight, as he encountered it, was robbing him of his wits. After that, he came towards the Greeks. They removed the intervening curtain. The reflection of those Chinese pictures and works of art struck upon these walls, which had been made pure from stain. All that he had seen there in the Chinese room seemed more beautiful here. It was snatching the eye from the socket. The Greek, O Father, are the Sufis. They are without, independent of study and books and erudition, but they have burnished their breasts and made them pure from greed and cupidity and avarice and hatreds. He goes on to say that purity of the mirror is beyond doubt the heart which receives images innumerable. And then he talks about Moses and so on. So that's, again, let's go back to that line. The Greeks, O Father, are the Sufis. So one of the controversies or one of the problems that Sufis had was the problem with between them and Muslim theologians and philosophers and also jurists, faqih, was their kind of depreciation of conventional study. So all these other Muslim scholars took a lot of time and energy and attempt to study the Quran and study the Hadith and study Islamic philosophy and this theology and that theology, and they were involved in all sorts of intellectual endeavors and debates and so on and so forth. But for Sufis like Rumi, although they had more or less the same kind of education, I mean, if Rumi hadn't had all these materials from his reading of the Quran and reading the Hadith and reading the stories and having a kind of imaginative mind by which he could tell these beautiful stories, he wouldn't have been able to be the Rumi that he is. So again, if, as I said, many commentators of Rumi have said that his book is Quran in Persian. So there are hundreds of exact, direct, explicit references to the verses of the Quran or the sayings of the Prophet of Islam, without any doubt. But his main point is that you can take these things as the end of the story, or you may take these things as a kind of hand post or an indicator towards something else, towards the truth. So then if you take it in this way, then you would not be limited to the sign itself. You would go beyond it and find the ultimate purpose behind it. So if you think of all these rituals that are in the Quran, or even all these practical recommendations and steps that I was just talking about in terms of how to achieve detachment, if you think of them as the end of the story, you are deceiving yourself, you are fooling yourself. All these things are means by which something ultimately can be hopefully achieved. So hence the emphasis is on the purity of heart. All these conventional studies, if they really do not really help us with the purity of heart, then they become a hindrance towards the spiritual perfection. Then again, for example, Rumi and others were quick to find references in the saying of the Prophet that knowledge can become the greatest hindrance towards the truth. This is his own word, al-ilmu hijabul akbar in Arabic. Ilm, knowledge, can become hijab, means curtain, means veil. Veil to the akbar, which means the greatest curtain between you and the truth. So one should study all these things, but at the same time, not think that that's the end of the story. Perhaps I should stop here and let you talk tonight more than I normally do. Thank you so much for your attention. So one thing is for you to really read some of the lines that I'm sure you are very much interested in Coleman Barks' book, Essentials of Rumi, or any other thing from Rumi in any other book. So anything that you are really interested to talk about in terms of the poetry or thought or question or critique, anything?
Well, the one question I have, he seems to hold up the Sufis and put down the scholars, those who study, but it seems that the Sufis would have to have some of that knowledge that the scholars have, and so what is the proper balance? Or
yeah, exactly, that's the main point. I mean, the thing that I was trying to really bring up from Rumi's perspective, that, as I said, and also you emphasized, it is necessary for any Sufi to be able to have this education in order to make any spiritual progress. But at the same time, it's the matter of balance, where you put your ultimate emphasis. If you think that these are, as many Muslim theologians and scholars thought, that this is the end of the story. You study the Quran, you study the Hadith of the Sunnah of the Prophet, and then you study also the fiqh, what to do and what not to do, what is clean, what is unclean. And then when you study all these things and you practice all these things in your life, then you have achieved what we were supposed to achieve by being religious, being pious. The emphasis by Sufi and by Rumi and other Sufis is that, as I said perhaps the other time, they were thinking about three things. So these are the terms that Sufis themselves, including Rumi, used in their discourse. One is Sharia, the legal aspect of Islam, which actually is not only in their usage, is not limited only to the legal aspect of Islam. It goes beyond that, and it can even include theology, commentary on the Quran, everything which is actually what we call religion. Because as I normally tend to say, Sharia is used in a narrow sense only to refer to the legal aspect of Islam, or in more broadly to include everything in the religion of Islam. So that's one, for the Sufis, that was the lowest level of being a good Muslim. A higher level is tariqa, which literally means path. And by the way, Sharia also literally means a path, particularly a narrow path to a big river from which you can take up some buckets of water or so, in the old days when there was no tap water. So the path towards a big river where you can get some water is called Sharia, literally. That's the literal sense in which Sharia is used in Arabic. But then the narrow sense is the legal aspect, and the broad sense is religion in general, religion of Islam or any other religion. Tariqa means also path. Tariqa mostly talks about these practical things that we were talking about, how to cultivate detachment. But even this, which is what the Sufis actually emphasize, for example, as I said, one part of his hunger. So in terms of Sharia, any ordinary Muslim would fast only 1 month of Ramadan. But apart from that, it is not, strictly speaking, against Sharia to be gluttonous. It's not. You can eat as much as you want. There is no problem with that. But from a Sufi point of view, there is a lot of problem with that. So it is not part of the, there is nothing against it in terms of Sharia, legal aspect of Islam, but spiritually speaking, eating as much as you want, gluttony is not good. So you should avoid it. But then again, one has to remember that all these things, the lower level, the middle level, they are all means towards the end, which is haqiqa, which means truth. You can identify it as God or the unity between human being and God, which is the truth from human perspective. So haqiqa is the truth. That's the ultimate end. So if you study the Quran and ahadith and fiqh, and even if you go beyond it and practice it in a more kind of vigorous way in the Sufi tradition, all these things, if they lead you to the truth, they have done their job. Otherwise, you are just going around and around.
I have some poems I would love to read, just little snippets. This one is from Chinese art and Greek art. In your light, I learn how to love. In your beauty, how to make poems. You dance inside my chest where no one sees you. But sometimes I do, and that sight becomes this art. And then my favorite.
Excuse me, before you go on.
Yes.
Was it part of, along with the part that I was just reading? Do you have the exact reference there? Or?
It just says Chinese art and Greek art. And it starts
because
with the
as
prophet.
Far as I remember, that's the only place where Rumi talks about in the two books, where he talks about the Chinese art and the Greek art. So I'm just wondering where I can find it.
Was it included in
those parts that
in
I
this
read?
Book? It's 121, page 121 in the Coleman Barks book.
So if you go back to the end of the book, can you find the exact reference there?
Yeah, I think so.
So I'm just wondering if I can find it here and perhaps go above it and below it to see if there are other things that we can share.
It just says Chinese art and Greek art.
No further reference?
Mm-mm.
Okay. So would you read it again, please?
Yes. And then I have my favorite one that I would like to read
after
that one. In your light, I learn how to love. In your beauty, how to make poems. You dance inside my chest where no one sees you. But sometimes I do, and that sight becomes this art.
Anything you would like to say about it?
I just love the image. Mm-hmm. I love the image of dancing, and yet it's private. No one sees you. But sometimes I see that dancing. Mm-hmm. And in that is art, and in that is beauty. Mm-hmm. I just think that's beautiful. Mm-hmm. But my favorite Rumi poem is from, snippet of poem, I should say, is from A Great Wagon, which is page 35 in the Coleman Barks book. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense. The breeze at dawn has secrets to tell you. Don't go back to sleep. You must ask for what you really want. Don't go back to sleep. People are going back and forth across the door sill where the two worlds touch. The door is round and open. Don't go back to sleep. I just think that's beautiful.
Thank you. Okay. I think I told you the story of Sheda's brother who, when we gather our family in Iran, he doesn't have a good, actually, voice, her brother, or he thinks so. I mean, I'm not sure. And then he asks other people to start to sing. And if they don't, then he says that kind of threatens others that if you do not sing, I would sing. Which would be a horrible thing in his own thought. So I'm just, again, threatening you. If you do not say anything, then I would go back to my notes and go to other stories. So that's a threat. You can take it seriously. One of the things that we can do, of course, the time is very short, perhaps, I don't know, maybe we have two more sessions within this semester, but something that can be helpful is you can send it, you can give it to me or send it to me by email, those parts that you would like to reflect on or you would like me to reflect on it. Then I will find the original one in Persian and perhaps there are nuances that are missed in the translation. Then we can come back next time and reflect on it together. Okay.
One in here where the title is Where Everything is Music.
Mm-hmm. Again, can you give me the reference? Because if you can find it quickly, then...
Well, it's on page 34 of this book, and I'm not sure if I can... quickly jump to,
okay, okay. No,
to the reference.
Okay, okay. Then we can but just read it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's under bewilderment. And of course, it starts with, I have five things to say under bewilderment. And then under that, there are snippets. This one is, where everything is music. Don't worry about saving these songs. And if one of our instruments breaks, it doesn't matter. We have fallen into the place where everything is music. The strumming and the flute notes rise into the atmosphere. And even if the whole world's harp should burn up, there will still be hidden instruments playing. So the candle flickers and goes out. We have a piece of flint and a spark. This singing art is sea foam. The graceful movements come from a pearl somewhere on the ocean floor. Poems reach up like a spindrift and the edge of the driftwood along the beach wanting. They derive from a slow and powerful root that we can't see. Stop the words now. Open the window in the center of your chest and let the spirits fly in and out. Once again, putting the form away and paying attention to the spirit.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay, any the name of the book, is it mentioned?
It just says, where is it, number 110?
So this is a reference of the part that he just read, yeah?
Right.
Okay. I think so, it's a reference, but I need to look into that because the number is there, but I don't know which edition of the Divan-e Shams. That must be the Divan-e Shams, not the book that I have brought now. Which edition of the Divan-e Shams that reference is referring to? So I need to look into it later. But maybe I can just make a quick comment, hopefully quick comment, on the role of music in the Sufi tradition. I'm sure at least some of you know that the use of music is not quite welcome in the Islamic tradition. For some reasons, I have my own theory about it. I'm not entirely sure whether that is true, but my understanding is that, I mean, for me, even prophets are human beings, still human beings, and all, if not all, but many of the limitations that restrict us in terms of knowledge, in terms of practice or everything has also, they also have their significance for even, I mean, prophets cannot revolutionize everything. They cannot bring about a totally new situation. They are not aware of everything. They are not gods. They are human beings. And many limits that we experience, limitations that we endure or whatever, they also endure. So the Prophet of Islam was not, in my understanding, was limited in terms of just trying to understand the situation in which he was living and responding to it in the most appropriate way. So one of the elements, cultural elements in his life was that, and there are many stories in the books written, there is, I think, 9 or 10 big volumes book written in Arabic on how life was going on before Muhammad arrived in Mecca, before he emerged. And many historians who have dealt with this era, which is called era of ignorance, Jahiliyyah in Arabic, which is the name used for the historical era before and around the coming of Muhammad to the historical, to human history. In that book, which is a book written by an Arab historian, he talks about different things, different structures in terms of legal structure, cultural structure of the kind of life that Arabs were leading before Muhammad emerged. One of the things is this, that normally the use of music was almost always accompanied by, music was used in the gatherings where there were the kind of excessive use of alcohol, excessive use of inappropriate mingling of men and women, and many, many things that Islam would not approve of later. So it was kind of unimaginable, inconceivable for the Prophet to think that there could be a very humane, proper use of music. When he heard music, or when he was thinking, or when he was asked about music, everything that came to his mind was that this is what music does, and this is when music is used. And there was no separation or distinction in his mind between a kind of good, appropriate music and other types. So that's why I think in the Islamic tradition, there are a couple of references, and there aren't much, actually, that would later be understood by Muslim scholars and faqih or legal expert of Islam as totally forbidding music. But interestingly, in the very beginning, I remember a Sufi in the second century, at the end of the second century Islamic era, which is 8th century Christian era, who said this, that in fact music doesn't do anything to human heart. It just brings up what is already there. If you harbor lusts and inappropriate thoughts and imaginations, that would bring it up. Music would kind of enhance that. At the same time, if you harbor a spiritual thought, that would help, music would help those kind of a spiritual thought. So music is not inherently illegal or inappropriate or something evil. It depends on how to use it. So that's Abu Sulaiman Darani, that's the name of the Sufi in the second Islamic era century, who second century of Islamic era, who got attention to this fact. And then many other Sufis in their gatherings, they came to realize that there is a good use, a spiritual use for music. And Rumi was in particular very keen to use music. So again, we were talking about controversies and tensions between Sufis in the Islamic tradition on the one hand and theologians or legal experts or others. So one of the points of controversy was about the use of music. So the legal experts of Islam, the faqih, were normally against it. And at least some Sufis, if not all of them, were totally in favor of it. And there were other things. There were other things between them. For example, let me give you this. One of the things that Rumi says is this, that there might be some situations where a human being, a Sufi, a Muslim, whatever, is not perhaps in those states, they are not bound by religious obligations. So for example, they do not have to pray anymore. They do not have to fast anymore. Those religious obligations do not apply at some situations. And that was totally off-putting and provocative from the perspective of the fuqaha. For the fuqaha, the legal experts of Islam, they think that these things are always and always obligatory for any Muslim under any circumstances. But the Sufis, Rumi has some lines, I can give you exact references in particular in this book, where he talks about a kind of permission. But what he has in his mind is this. So this is one of the similes or analogies that he uses. He says that when you are far from your beloved, of course, one of the things to relate to your beloved is to send letters, love letters. But if you are sitting next to beloved, does it make sense to give him a letter of love? You are in his own presence. What does letter of love do when you are in the presence of your beloved? So for him, all these religious obligations, again, are means, not the end. And when you are in the presence of the beloved, you are there already. You do not have to use all these kind of things. So where hypothetically, a Sufi reaches those high states of what they call in Arabic fana, which means, which can be translated as annihilation, when the whole ego of the Sufi is totally annihilated by the fire of the love relationship between a human being and God, when that ego is totally destroyed or annihilated, when fana is reached, it's like you are in the presence of your beloved. In those states, you are not obliged to do the religious things. So that was another point of controversy between the experts of Islamic tradition and the Sufis. So I'm just giving you some examples. But although Rumi does talk about it in a couple of places in this book, so there is a place for that in his thought, but he never considers himself to be exempt from or what is the word, exempt, I think, in English, exempt from those rules. He has always and always felt that he was obligated, and he did all his prayers and fasting and pilgrimage to Mecca and everything. So he was an ordinary Muslim in all senses of the term. But he kind of did envisage that there might be some possibilities for some Sufis at some, even you can say, very temporary and fleeting states in their life that they may come to this kind of experience. So even that was problematic. But Rumi tended to not develop any kind of tension between himself and the faqih or the legal experts of Islam in his own time. But one thing, he couldn't actually go beyond it and compromise on it. And that was the use of music. He said that, I can accept whatever you say, talking to the Muslim jurists of his time. I can go as far as you want. I can do whatever you say, and I would be totally in agreement with you. But something that you should compromise is to let me use music. And he had a specific kind of instrument, musical instrument, that he would use, which is called rabab in Persian. Maybe the word is Turkish. So that was the only thing that in practice he used, and the Muslim jurist of his time would not really approve of it. There is another point behind it, and I'm going to stop here, was that in Sufi's kind of cosmology or philosophy, whatever you may call it, they thought that everything in this world which brings beauty or meaning or a meaningful movement in the world is where something revolves around something else. So think about the revolving of all the stars or planets around the sun and everything in the world. And that's why they thought that human beings also have to cultivate that, to dance, to revolve around something. And that's why, actually, Rumi didn't initiate any Sufi order. His son, Sultan Balad, who was his son, actually, he initiated the specific order, which is called Maulaviya. Rumi didn't initiate any Sufi order. His son was responsible for that. But as you can see, this particular order is characterized by whirling dervishes. They just, I'm sure you have seen it, film of it, or their real dancing. So this is actually derived from this kind of philosophy that revolving around, and what, when they do it, they think that they are revolving around the beloved in that very specific way. So there is a kind of philosophy behind the use of music and the use of dance, which is called sama in Arabic. And interestingly, sama literally means listening. So, which is the word used in the Sufi order to refer to that specific dance. And the interesting point behind it is that this dance is a means towards an end, which is to be able to listen the truth of God. And it's not just listening by your ears, it is listening by the whole existence of the Sufi. But I'm sure some of you at least know about a kind of background to this. If there is a philosophical, in Greek philosophy, there is a background to this whole notion of dancing and revolving around the sun and the planets revolving around something, either the sun in the new astronomy or in the old Ptolemaic astronomy revolving around the earth. Anyway, this revolving around something had got some kind of philosophical or spiritual significance for some Greek philosophers, and there is an element of influence from the Greek philosophy on Islamic philosophy on that particular point. Any question, any comment?
How about reciting one of those poems?
comes in Persian.
In Persian? I just embarrass myself. If you are really content with me embarrassing myself, then I would be content with your you being content with embarrassing me. Okay, one. So, okay, can just go to those lines that we perhaps read the other time, the first 18 lines of the first book of Rumi's Masnavi, where he talks about the reed flute and his separation from the reed bed. I'm sure you remember that.
بشنوینه چون شکایت می کند از جدایی ها حکایت می کند که از نیستان تا مرا ببریدند در نفیرم مرد و زن نالیدند سینه خواهم شرح شرح از فراق تا بگو شرح درد اشتیاق.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Amir, for another very stimulating evening, and thank you all for coming. And we'll meet again on Rumi in 2 weeks. So thank you.